Woohoo! 2017! We made it! Oh yeah! Only 3 years left! Oh yeah! Welcome to the Soulcast. It's first podcast of the year. And it's an honor to have my homie Stephen Polk on today. This is a great interview. Stephen is a professor in Boulder at Naropa, where he teaches permaculture. I've known Stephen for 6 or 7 years. And, you know, I don't know, over the last 6 months or so, I've become obsessed with permaculture. And the more I've been researching it from my garden, the more I'm recognizing how a lot of the ideas in here line up with a lot of my ideas about anarchism. And lo and behold, my good friend Stephen has done a lot of work around talking about the relationships between anarchy and permaculture, and kind of going back to the early roots of people like Kropotkin, and tying it in with the works of Murray Bookchin more recently. And so this is a fucking awesome conversation, because, you know, 2017 is going to be a year with so many things to be pissed off about. But at the same time, I think it's also important for people to learn new practices and new ways of, you know, healing the environment and healing ourselves and having fun while doing it. And that's why I love gardening. And so to tie that in with politics is fucking amazing. And so this is a really cool, cool interview. Stephen is a fucking badass. He just launched this new website called Popular Power. Check it out. It's popular-power.org. If you fuck with the Soulcast, please rate it in iTunes. Go in there and click 5 stars. Write a review about what you think about it. That helps the algorithms. And if you want to support the Soulcast, you can do so by becoming a monthly sustainer on Patreon for as little as $2 a month. That's patreon.com/SOLEONE. And this episode is made possible by generous donations from James Dumont, Aldi Wilcox, Eric Ireland, and Robert Boyle. So here's the interview with Stephen. Check it out, and let me know what you think. One last thing. Sorry, not sorry. My dogs were very loud during this interview, but that's what happens. Steve Polk, how you doing, man?
Good, how are you?
Welcome to the Soulcast.
Thank you.
So what's the weather today? It's like 65 degrees out?
Yeah, 65 degrees, which means if you're in the sun, it's fucking perfect.
It's amazing.
Yeah, man. No, it's pretty good.
Fucking, thank you, Exxon.
Yeah. we'll get these days in December, January. If this keeps up for a long time, I'll be concerned. I was actually really concerned in November. We had an 80-degree day on November 15th or something. And there was, like, shit blooming, like roses in full bloom in, like, early November. It was insane.
Yeah, we had tomatoes pretty much until Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
Picking tomatoes until Thanksgiving this year.
Yeah.
So you just started teaching at Naropa.
Mm-hmm.
How is that?
It's good. It's definitely kind of a change of pace for me. I was really involved in... I've been involved in a number of things, but over this last year, I just came back from New York and wanted to really get involved in, like, housing justice issues, and I did do that with an organization called People Rising Against Poverty.
Mm-hmm.
And we were working in a coalition to figure out how to create movement around the fact that landlords can raise the rent on anyone in the city with 10 days notice by whatever amount they want. The fact that, you know, housing or the cost of living has outpaced wages by a ratio of 3-1 in Colorado over the last 14 years. And in Denver, I would imagine it's much higher. But how I saw it was that we were losing a battle in the city, and that you know, housing justice, because it affects everyone, could be a potentially explosive sort of movement that we could leverage genuine people power, not just for housing justice, but beyond. And try to make it in the sort of nonprofit housing world, and struggled to find work and for about 2 solid years. And then Naropa was hiring for a permaculture teacher, and it was a full-time gig, and threw my hat in the ring and got hired, and yeah, it's awesome. Super supportive faculty and colleages, and there's a greenhouse that we have on campus with a fig tree and a lemon tree, and we have a growing food forest, and like just in front of Naropa College right there. So it's an amazing space to be able to to be able to grow as an educator, to grow my knowledge in permaculture, and also activism. And yeah, I've kind of seen my role shift a little bit in terms of not just as an organizer, but I don't know, as being able to like provide alternatives to the existing system. So in addition to like activist kind of oppositional like housing justice, I've also been involved in cooperative and collective living here in Denver, and have helped set up 5 collectives, 2 of which still exist. And we're now trying to figure out how to create a member-owned, democratically controlled, affordable housing cooperative. And so, yeah, so we're on the path of that as well.
That's what you're doing. That's where you currently live,
yeah.
Right? Yeah, yeah. You're trying. So you, well, you bought a house, mm-hmm. and you're turning it into a collectively run space, which is fucking insane. I would never do that.
Yeah. Right. I mean, a lot of it is just the fact that my partner and I have access to a lot of privilege, and kind of feel it's our responsibility to give back. And this is a skill set that we have, and also willing to explore further. So we figured, why not? And for me, just living in this way is it's natural, and I think it's healthy. And I don't see any other reason to live any other way.
Right.
And the relationships that I've been able to build, like out of living this way, and like have really supported me through the years. And also too,
living this way, you mean living in a cooperative?
Yeah, living housing. In a like shared housing cooperative. So right now we have 6 people. And also too, I mean, people, like when you're cooperating with people, you know, you don't need a washing machine for, you know, every 4 people. You don't need a dishwasher for every 4 people.
Right.
And in fact, I heard a statistic from a friend of mine who's also involved in this, saying that people who live cooperatively consume, it's either a third less or like only a third of like the average sort of like consumer. So in that way, I feel like it gives back to like the earth in that sense.
That's awesome, man. Yeah, I mean, and that's, I've known you for like 6 years now,
mm-hmm.
and I know you from another one of your earlier projects was this Denver-wide co-op housing network also, mm-hmm. that you were involved in, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, well, yeah, a group of us got together back in 2012, with the explicit purpose of kind of creating a cooperative amongst cooperatives, or collective amongst collectives, so that we can further leverage our cooperative energy to ever greater heights. And we had a number of different ideas that came out of this, and you were involved in some of those discussions. We looked into creating like a community-produced agriculture,
mm-hmm.
Where collectives and individuals could participate in a project where we would all grow our own food and figure out some sort of system of equitable distribution. And I think where we got hung up was like that equitable distribution aspect.
Right.
You know, are there going to be, you know, is it going to be central planning? You know, is it going to be more of like a gift sort of, you know, exchange? And then from that, we kind of moved on to the idea of creating kind of like an alternative economy where it was based on like time banking, and kind of like develop this elaborate system around it to be able to more equitably distribute and disseminate goods and resources and skills and knowledge amongst the kind of collective community.
Hey! get over it. Sorry, man. No, it's can't control. They're wild, man. Can't control them.
They're dogs.
Shh. Yeah, like Sean was choking rabbits in his garage. And, he did that for a while, right?
He was raising rabbits. He was.
He's fucking intense, man.
No, he is. He's like, so much respect for him. He does what he says he does.
Yeah.
And it's like, it says what he's going to do, and I really respect that. And I don't know. I'm like, what I got out, the takeaway from that experience was that, alternative economies, first and foremost, are incredibly complex. And so long as people believe in and rely on the dollar to meet their basic needs, to intervene in that process with an alternative just getting off the ground, it's hard. It's not to say that it's impossible. There's like the Ithaca dollar. I think there's a few other municipalities that have been experimenting.
The Denver Buck,
right. But, you know, the Bluebird dollar, Bluebird, like East Colfax had a, like Business Improvement District had an alternative currency they're trying to get off the ground for a long time. I just think it's too complex and too difficult to compete with that. I think my efforts are far better in other areas.
Yeah, I think it's better. I mean, to me, it just makes more sense to have like a swap meet, you know, like a summer swap meet where people who are producing things get together and trade and share, you know, which is, you know, again, it's like, that could be really cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also having this like work days or in permaculture, it's often called like a permablitz, but you invite 20 of your friends over and you already have a design, like, you know, fully developed, and you buy some beer and pizza and, you know, spend a day in the garden, and with 20 people you can accomplish what you can never alone. Right.
Right.
And I guess, yeah, those sort of like ad hoc projects are well underway and thriving.
I mean, it's funny you mentioned that because I remember when Adam Brock, who used to live around the corner from me, who was one of the, you know, permaculture peeps out here who I've learned a lot from, he had like this, hey, you know, permaculture action day. Yeah, and we went over there and I was like, this motherfucker, like, he's just got all these people digging all this, you know, doing it, planting his garden for him. Like, this is amazing, you know? But then in the same time, like, we all learned swales. Yeah. We all learned, like, how he was, like, digging things at different heights. And, like, even if I didn't grasp everything he was doing, you know, I picked up just so much in that tiny, tiny bit of time. And it's like, so it's like, I think part of, like when we think about alternative economies and stuff, I think it's important to think that, like, not everything, you know, not everything is what it seems. Like, a lot of times when you're giving, you're also receiving. Right. You know, like, you're, every time you go and do something nice for someone, you're learning something, you're gaining from that, so.
Yeah, no, it's two things, though. One, you learn permaculture best by doing. And so, yeah, showing up at someone's house, what you're gaining is invaluable experience that's going to, like, help your project succeed in another area, right, or further down the road. And then the other one, like, when you're, you know, by helping someone out, you're also helping yourself. And I think that's, like, a basic concept of mutual aid. That, you know, we're only as strong as our neighbors. We're only as strong as, like, the homeless people on the streets. That, you know, on any scale, right? A strong community is made up of strong individuals and vice versa. And I think it's a myth that we have to get ours first, right?
Right.
And I think we're weaker for it, like, in a number of ways. But I think that concept of mutual aid, like, is a basis of, like, permaculture theory.
Yeah, I mean, they use different language for it. But, well, okay, before we get deep into permaculture, like, I'm just digging in and getting obsessed with permaculture ever since. I interviewed Adam on my podcast. Did you listen to that?
I did.
God, right, I was just like,
that was awesome.
I was like, I love this guy. Yeah. Like, I can't believe how smart he is. And then, like, I just, like, ever since then, I've just, like, gone on this quest where I've just been like, like, it's just totally just changed, and so many things about it are so in sync with, like, my vision of anarchism, mm-hmm. and or anarchy. And I mean, granted, to a lot of anarchy, a lot of anarchists, and I seem like a hippie anyway. Mm-hmm. But so I guess like the main thing where I wanted to talk to you was because you've been doing all this study around the relationships between anarchy and permaculture. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about what some of those? What's going on there? Why mm-hmm. why do you think these two things are so linked?
Yeah, and so we're actually talking outside a little bit ago, out in the sun, short sleeve,
70 degree winter, typical January weather.
Like I, you know, was politicized during the anti-war years, and that's when I was like introduced to anarchism and really kind of dived into it. And it was only later that like I came onto permaculture after I started living collectively, and first reading permaculture, like it just made sense. That like, oh, this is, you know, a means by which we can, or permaculture is a means by which we can, you know, arrive at some of the sensibilities required for anarchism. That there's a huge wealth of information between there. And in fact, my master's thesis was about this topic specifically. And I think I got into, you know, laid out some of the groundwork in that thesis from which I can build like a, you know, larger argument. But at the same time, realize that other people have been making these connections for a long time. Like somewhat contemporaries, Murray Bookchin in Social Ecology, where he's calling for, you know, democratization of society, you know, not just politically, but, you know, economically in the workplace, you know, socially in the neighborhoods, as well as a correlative ecological ethics or ecological sensibility. And that for him, you know, the increased socialness of increased cooperation based on mutual aid and ecological ethics to him are paramount and fundamental to a future liberatory society. And I hold those beliefs as well.
Yeah, I mean, he, as you were talking, I was just like, bing, 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 bing. I totally forgot about Murray Bookchin. Mm-hmm. And like it reminds me of like he had this thing where they were like linking together laundry machines and raising tilapia under
Murray Bookchin.
Yeah, he like they had created like linked together all these like dead fucked up laundry machines, and they were like harvesting tilapia in basements in Burlington, Vermont.
No shit.
You know, yeah.
Okay. So well, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Bookchin. I didn't know about his like practical ecological experiments. That's cool.
Yeah, it is cool. It is cool.
But yeah, I mean, essentially, permaculture gives us a guide to become more effective and more meaningful ecological actors, as well as like more sustainable and regenerative ecological actors. And sort of no, I'm not sure of any other sort of approach to like humans and nature right now that provides such a comprehensive guidebook and like strategy-based approach, as well as a philosophical underpinnings of permaculture. So for that, like I think it's incredibly important, and I see it playing a more crucial role in the future of kind of activism in general. Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I mean, again, it's just another methodology. You know, like you're, mm-hmm. once you get really into anarchy, you start to see the world through that lens. And then, but with the permaculture stuff, it's like once you start like really wrapping your head around these ideas, it makes perfect sense. Whereas like for me, as an entrepreneur, self-employed artist, who really values food, I can't afford to be spending $30 a week on spices and like and all this shit. And so it's like, I can't afford tomatoes. I can't, you know? And so I grow all that shit, and I've been doing that for a long time. So I think just gardening in itself is super liberatory, mm-hmm. for all these reasons. Mm-hmm. But then once you add like these idea, the other concepts of permaculture, like, you know, like these ideas of cooperation, and you start, mm-hmm. to really understand like the way that, I don't know. And then like all of a sudden it's like I took the blue pill or something. Yeah. And then all of a sudden I started recognizing these patterns in society as well.
Right.
Like the thing I thought of first and foremost was, or recently when the Rhinoceropolis got shut down, I was thinking, what did y'all think? You're a secession crop. Mm-hmm. You know, like we artists we're the pioneer crops,
right?
You know, we're the ones who, you know, artists and punks, yeah. If you look at gentrification, right, mm-hmm. artists and punks are like the ones who go into, you know, poor, like on the edges of society, mm-hmm. you know, and like we're pioneers, we're the settlers, mm-hmm. and even though we don't think of ourselves that way, like that's the role that, like, you know, the vanguard or whatever. And so when that spot when the Rhinoceropolis got shut down, I was just mm-hmm. like, oh well, I guess the edge got pushed back a little bit,
yeah.
you know?
Yep. Yeah, I know, and that's yeah, and you know, living in collectives and cooperatives, you know, for the last 12 years in Denver, like, admittedly, we were on that edge and pushing that edge, and we were, to use a term that I don't like in permaculture for obvious reasons, but we were like the pioneer species, right? The first, the first succession. And
I mean, it's just like a poetic game I'm yeah. playing, really.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that it's... that's a useful sort of like metaphor, right? Or allegory. You know, I don't think we can extend the ecological metaphor into like all aspects of life,
right.
and nothing. There's probably a danger or just ineffectiveness in doing right. that in general. But it does give us a new vocabulary, right, to speak about, you know, systems and their impact on us. And, you know, speaking about that impact, I see, the need for a social justice analysis within permaculture, and at its very base, you know, it's, you know, for people who are, you know, pushed further out to the margins, you know, it increases their daily labor commute, it increases their reliance on unsustainable resources, it takes them out of their social location, where they probably developed, you know, ties necessary to their survival, whether it's everything from, you know, like actually sharing money, but to childcare, to sharing food, to, you know, maybe growing food together. But so long as people are, you know, forced out of those locations, the prospects for a vibrant ecological society, one in which I think permaculture envisages, are incredibly few. And so we simultaneously have to engage in permaculture issues, which is, you know, to use this ecological metaphor again, we start sinking flows of energy in neighborhoods where people exist. And how you maximize the sinking of those flows of energies is through increased cooperation between people and between people and other species. And that can only happen with some degree of tenancy, especially in permaculture with perennial plants. Unless we have, you know, long-term engagement with a particular place, you know, we're going to be out there breaking our backs over annuals, you know,
right.
indefinitely. And that leads into, in my opinion, a much broader critique of capitalism in general, and the current design of our cities. And I think one of the biggest barriers to, like, you know, a truly ecological city, if we can imagine such a thing from our current, you know, historical position, but is design, right? I mean, our cities are designed around cars, and they're designed around nuclear houses and or like in apartment complexes, like shut off from everyone where there's no social space. But, you know, further down the road, once we have a firm sense of housing justice and everyone has a home, then we can start to tackle some of those bigger design issues that are structural, that are infrastructural, which will require in the beginning, I think, some degree of, you know, a lot of resources to accomplish that. But the end goal is, you know, far greater. But, yeah.
Well, as you're talking about creating these sites or whatever, earlier we were talking about how the cities are designed in the with the model of neoliberalism. Every form of energy that the city wants is essentially for capitalism. So is it possible now to like design spaces in cities that are against the flow of capital that mm-hmm. can increase that cooperation? Like, can permaculture be used for that mm-hmm. without it being recuperated mm-hmm. by capitalism?
Right. That's a very interesting question. I was on a panel for the Denver Permaculture Guild earlier in the fall, and there was I think it was an executive director of like a local organization that was growing food in an abandoned lot in like a low-income, primarily community of color neighborhood, and over the last 3 years it had grown. Like, they had grown trust from the neighbors, and, you know, especially if you're, like, a white person, or primarily white people going into, like, a neighborhood like that, building trust takes a lot of time. And a lot of that trust is premised on whether or not you're going to be a stable tenant into the future, whether or not people can actually rely on, you know, the services that you're trying to offer. And in the current city, the forces of private capital, assisted by the political system, are far too great for a community to be able to like resist that sort of gentrification. And those forces are so great based on kind of the current social and political like level that people are at. I mean, I don't see people organizing around a space to defend it in Denver. Right. I don't think we're politically there yet. It's not to say that it can't happen, but it is to say that a whole lot more work needs to be done if we're to achieve, a whole lot more political organizing is needed in order to achieve like the like desired result of like sinking our resources where we're at. But so I think there are barriers to what permaculture can offer, like currently in the neoliberal city. But I think that, you know, we start with what's in front of us. You know, we start by growing gardens and inviting our friends over. You know, maybe it's something as simple as putting like placards on a garden that you're growing so that passersby can read what you're growing and like the outputs of that and how it can improve their life, right? I mean, that's just, you know, kind of skirting at the edges.
But it still changes people's relationship with
right.
the city. It's like you were talking about how when you and your homies were... When y'all would go out and pick fruit trees, mm-hmm. it was like this radical performance, and people would be like, "Oh my God, you can't do that! What is that? You're gonna die!"
Right?
Like, dude, these are fucking apples.
Right. This is where your apples and your cherries come from. They come from trees, right? Well, just like as an indication of like where people are at, not just politically and socially, but also in terms of their understanding of ecosystems. Very few people understand that. Their food, you know, their fruit comes from trees, their potatoes come from the ground, and their, you know, peppers are grown on a plant, right? And so anything that we can do that demonstrates, you know, that like where food comes from, you know, will and can increase people's connection. And I think it's like a powerful form of activism, powerful form of like permaculture activism.
Right. Here's One of the things I was thinking about is how, and I hate to use the word ghetto, but I can't think of another term. If you have another term, please throw it at me. But like, up to a certain point, I feel like anarchism or anarchy exists in a sort of subcultural ghetto. Mm-hmm. And I feel like permaculture does as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, and how do we break them out? How do we break them out of those subcultural ghettos and make mm-hmm. them useful for everyone?
Yeah, that's a huge question.
Obviously.
Right. Well, it's a question I've been grappling with over the last 12 years. I mean, kind of my departure from like radical like political theory or being like so engaged in it and having that be a primary like driver of my actions, and you know, that kind of stopped after a while because I'm a educated, incredibly privileged, like white cis male that's overeducated, and the sort of you know theories that I'm talking about on the street, I don't resonate with people, right? I mean, just like going back to this idea before, where I think socially and politically, like we're not capable of amassing a lot of people power towards you know collective ends or collective dreams or visions of a city, and to go even further than that. I think we lack, like, in maybe it's particular to the United States or Western countries or, you know, other societies, but we lack a general political literacy. excuse me. I have a lot of friends, or in my classes, my freshman seminars, I have students coming in who don't know the difference between a Republican or a Democrat, much less their relationship to either, and far less their relationship to what Marx or Bakunin or Kropotkin or even Murray Bookchin said. And so they're... And just relating at it to how I related, my political socialization was through engagement in political action, of actually like learning how the system can operate, of you know also experiencing the defeat of 30 million people in the streets on February 15th, 2003, you know just weeks before, a month before the bombing started in Iraq, and you know kind of experiencing that defeat that even 30 million in the peak. 30 million people in the streets globally, not just in the West, but you know, South America, Europe, Asia, the Middle East. That we can stop that, but that was an educational moment for me, right? And in retrospect, actually, I think the protests were incredibly successful at mitigating, you know, some of the atrocities of war. But in general, we lack a basic political literacy, and I think that's a lot of the work that we need to be engaged in is, you know, is over that, right? And also understanding what power is. You know, how to get power, and then how to use power towards our collective ends in a way that doesn't violate our values. And those sorts of questions, like, I'm, like, constantly grappling with. You know, why, speaking in terms of permaculture, right, you want the greatest effect for the least amount of work. What is going to allow me to be an effective political actor given our current circumstances? And I don't necessarily have a ready response for that, but I think a lot of it is, you know, based on experience and practice and experimentation of what works and what doesn't work. And same with permaculture, it requires an ecological literacy. And I think permaculture does an incredibly effective job as it exists currently on teaching people how to be an effective actor in an ecological system. I would like to see more political, like, education and literacy. Because the two are inseparable, in my opinion. But the original question was, how do you kind of bring those out of the ghetto? I mean, I think a lot of it is meeting people where they're at.
Right.
And not talking at people. They're not holding on to sort of one theory as the only correct theory for the future course of society. But I don't know. That's my opinion.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm right with you, man. Yeah. I mean, it's like I have my critiques of a lot of people, but one of the things I heard that really resonated me with, like look, Trump got elected. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody's sitting around crying, yeah. You know, and they're like, whatever it is you do, do it good. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, I can do that, you know? Like, I felt like this immediate urge, like, okay, now I have to start doing teach-ins on, like, the limits of nonviolence. I have to mm-hmm. do this. I have to publish this. I have mm-hmm. to do that. And then it was like, wait, no. I have to make good music. Mm-hmm. I have to, like, do the things I'm already doing right. and, like, put my effort into places where it's going to yield the maximum results, mm-hmm. you know? So it's, like, helping getting the assemblies off the ground and helping, like, bring people together and, right. like, and so it's, like, doing little things. And I think that's, like, a problem, again, to use a permaculture metaphor. It's like when you till the soil, you know, you get a quick little boost of energy or whatever, but you're actually wiping out the bacteria under the ground. And so it's like if you just rush at a problem and like exert all of your fucking energy up front, like, yeah, we're gonna go hella hard in January, and then like next thing you know, everybody's on probation, everybody's burnt out, everybody's pissed at each other, and then there's like nothing. So it's like our engagements have to be sustainable and meaningful for them to have any kind of impact. And again, that makes sense. Like, we're putting in the putting in the minimal amount of effort where it's going to have the maximum output.
Right.
You know.
Right. Yeah, and I think kind of like what I thought of, like when you were talking, was, you know, I think there's time for political mobilization. And those times arise when we're able to sort of observe like the political environment and realize that, you know, realize that, you know, of all the strategies that we have at our disposal, this is going to be the most effective, or this one strategy will be the most effective to achieve our collective goals. And I mean, that sort of like strategic level thinking or that tactical level thinking, I think requires a shit ton of practice, and knowledge and experience with the political system.
Does it blade noise?
Oh, no. Oh. No, I'm fine. Yeah, shit ton of knowledge of the political system that, like, I don't, like, after, you know, 12 years of being involved in, like, grassroots politics, I don't feel like I necessarily understand. And again, that's like speaking to the sort of lack of political like literacy or education in this country, which also filters into a lack of political imagination, right, and political will. But if we can't imagine what is possible, then of course we're not going to bring it into fruition.
Right.
And then on this idea like of sustainability, yeah, there's time for political mobilization, but there's also time, and I'm a firm believer of this, that we have to start creating the world that we want to see in the here and now. This idea of prefiguration, that we're going to, you know, build projects that prefigure the future that we want to live. And I think that without that anchor, I think it's problematic for a number of reasons. Chief among them is that if we don't know like what freedom is, or at least like preliminary steps on how to arrive at whatever definition of freedom we're working on, then how do we know what it is that we want in general? How do we know that that's going to be desirable? And with prefiguration, also too, I mean, if we're yelling and screaming that the current system is unsustainable, we better have at least like, in this unsustainable system is a huge ship, right? The Titanic. If we're not offering people life rafts where, you know, like that they can at least hold on to or learn some skills to be able to like lessen their reliance on that boat or whatever, then, you know, we're not going to make much gains. Also too, through prefiguration, we gain the skills required to become effective political and ecological actors. For example, the last 12 years, just by virtue of the fact of sitting in consensus meetings, oftentimes painful consensus meetings, with as many as, you know, 17 or 20 roommates on a weekly basis, like, you learn skills on how to facilitate. You learn skills on how to bring people together, to move people from point A to point B, together in a way that is amenable to all. And then, like, those are some of the skills that I've learned that are incredibly essential and serve multiple functions in the political realm and ecological realm. But if we're not engaged in those actions, yeah, we're not going to be sustainable.
Right.
Because, you know, we can protest till we're blue in the face. Or maybe, you know, like pass a few policies that ease like the suffering of people. For example, Denver Homeless Out Loud's attempt to pass, this will be their third year to attempt to pass the Colorado Homeless Bill of Rights. I mean, that sort of legislation is absolutely necessary to protect people in the streets from dying. People whose only like aim right now is survival.
Right.
I mean, absolutely essential that those sorts of laws are passed. And I praise Denver Homeless Out Loud for engaging in those projects, but if we're not simultaneously like offering like a solution to the problem, then I think we're spinning our wheels.
So you're talking about the urban camping ban, where mm-hmm. anybody who sleeps in the city of Denver can go to jail for up to a year, mm-hmm. Just for covering themselves with mm-hmm. a blanket, just for people listening who don't know what that is.
Right.
And but okay, so you're an anarchist, right?
I have a interesting relationship to that word. I like anarchist theory and philosophy is most inspiring to me, and I see that as like the end game. In the meantime, like, I don't see any like use in being like attached to that label, not just because of the sort of images that it conjures up, but also because, like, I and this is also, like, I think a core theory of anarchism, but an adherence to, like, democracy and democratic principles, that if we're to open up the institutions responsible for the administration of daily life to ever more democratic control by far, like, greater numbers of people, the end result of that may not actually be anarchism. And I think it is our responsibility, my responsibility, to always advocate for, you know, firm ethics and principles that are in line with anarchism, but I see no reason to call myself that.
Okay, yeah, because I was just wondering, because, you know, a lot of people be like, oh my God, I'm not, you're supporting an electoral, you know, reform.
Oh, sure.
You know?
Yeah, well, no, I mean, and that's where, like, anarchism completely breaks down for me. Like, I feel that that's, like, a sort of dogmatism that I'm not interested in engaging in. And kind of based on what I said before, but it is through engagement with the political system that we learn not only how to be an effective and meaningful actor in that realm, but it's also, too, that, like, at least for me, a lot of the contradictions of capitalism, especially its current form, are revealed to me. For example, one moment that I can point to was, you know, marching in the street as peaceful protesters and having what appeared to be, or having a domestic security agent, maybe the police or state patrol, we got this a lot during Occupy, pointing what appeared to be a semi-automatic rifle at us for nothing other than occupying a park.
Right.
And it's those sorts of moments that I think we need to be increasing for people. I mean, not necessarily putting them in harm's way, but engaged in political action. Because again, like, if you're not engaging people in political action, if you're only existing on a fairly high esoteric level of theory and analysis and strategy, it's incredibly difficult to gain critical mass towards anything.
Right.
And I think there's a function for that. I mean, I think that people who, you know, espouse those beliefs, like, just a part of any ecosystem, we need a lot of diversity, a lot of diversity of thought and tactics and action and strategy. And I think that's incredibly healthy and successful. It's personally where I don't see myself as being an effective actor.
Yeah, well, especially, it's like, if we talk about diversity of tactics, it can't just mean one thing.
Right.
It can't just mean smashing windows. It's gonna, it's gonna be like, yeah, like,
right.
Let people do what they think will work, and if it's not gonna work, they're gonna learn the hard way.
Right.
You know? In your thesis, you make a distinction between, an important distinction between anarchism and anarchy.
Right.
Can you talk about that?
Right. So, and I believe it was Colin Ward who also made this distinction. I could be wrong on that. But anarchism is essentially a theory developed by, like, Europeans a couple hundred years ago, that is based on, you know, concepts of mutual aid, based on concepts of voluntary association, like non-coercive, self-organizing society. And, you know, I mean, personally, I think that's incredibly beautiful, and I think we should, you know, strive for that. But I distinguish that primarily as a theory, whereas, like, anarchy is perhaps, like, the living out of anarchic principles, whether or not a particular actor may be aware that it's anarchism. And in my thesis, it was ethnographic or participant observation of some of the collective houses that I was living in. But it was largely, in my opinion, in my analysis, an anarchic sort of social relationship, where people in the house decided equally through consensus on matters ranging from the dishes, right, which is all too common, and we can talk about the fucking dishes, but it happens, right? There's that slogan.
Hey, we, like, even have that problem in the nuclear family.
Right. Well, it's like, there's that slogan, like, you know, how can we have a revolution if we can't do the dishes, sort of thing. So, I mean, that's important, you know, to, like, broader discussion over how do we reconcile our values with how we're self-organizing in this house. And in collective houses, you have those conversations all the time. And I think that, you know, that's a glimpse into what an anarchic society might look like. And I think with democracy in general, it's constantly this reconciling of our self-interests and, you know, desires with a much larger whole. You know, how do we navigate that space? And it's an art, and it's something that, you know, but I think a prerequisite for effective democratic participation. And I see that the same in anarchism, right? And Cindy Milstein talks a bit about this in a recent book, I can't remember the title of, where she talks about anarchism is about reconciling and maximizing personal freedom with collective solidarity. Then those two can often be at odds with each other. But it's that sort of tension where anarchists, you know, should thrive and should be able to navigate. And yeah, I totally forgot the original question.
Well, no, that's fine. It was basically the relationship between anarchy and anarchism.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
To me, I just think it's like dogma. Like,
yeah, yeah.
It's like leaving the dogma behind, right?
Right. Well, yeah, and I was saying this outside, but you know, if we're to open up those institutions that are responsible for daily administration of, you know, all people to democratic control, and also create new institutions in the process, you know, the end result may be something that we didn't really foresee, maybe for good reason, maybe for bad reason, right? But does our adherence to democratic, you know, does our value for democracy supersede our value for any sort of, like, anarchist dogma or theoretical dogma? Everyone has to answer that question for themselves. For me personally, I'm going to err on the side of democracy, right? Of course, I'm going to insert my own values and... you know, like, stand behind firmly, uncompromisingly, behind, right, like, you know, anti-racism, you know, like, anti-oppression, like, ecological ethics, earth care, people care, fair share, uncompromisingly stand behind those because that's essential, right, for
right.
me. But, yeah, I don't know. That's
whereas, like, if that, but what if the you know, your bloc decides they want to elect a president?
Yeah,
you know,
right.
We're gonna have a president of Capitol Hill.
Right, right, right. Who is, you know, unresponsive to the needs of the people? I mean, fascism can emerge from a system like that just as easily as fascism is emerging currently in our, like, democratic republic. It's not to say that, you know, any future experiment in how we organize ourselves is going to be immune from any sort of thing that we don't like.
Whether it's, what do you mean? this is why we're having reading groups. Well, speaking of dead white guys, another thing that you know, I brought up to you during, when we were texting back and forth, mm-hmm. was, like, you know, Emma Goldman's first book, mm-hmm. was called Mother Earth, you right. know, her for her newsletter that she did, and Peter Kropotkin came up studying evolution, and, mm-hmm. and he was a biologist, right?
Right. Yeah.
And that's where his theories of mutual aid came from. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that a little bit, like the relationship between early anarchist thought,
yeah.
and what the parallels are in permaculture?
Yeah. So the, like, with Emma Goldman and the naming of, like, her publication Mother Earth, that, like, why she named it that, and its implications towards ecology is unclear to me, so I can't really speak to that. But I mean, Kropotkin, who is writing, like, after Darwin, he's a contemporary of Darwin, was very adamant at pointing out, like, one aspect of Darwin's theory that everyone was kind of, like, holding on to and grasping at, which was a fundamental flaw of reading Darwin. With drastic consequences, negative consequences, which is that society is a, or that existence is about competition, and that what drives evolution forward is competition. And of course, if we take that idea into the social realm, we get some pretty scary ideas, right? Social Darwinism,
war.
And war, right? And it's very, that sort of view of evolution, like a biological life, of ecological life, is, you know, akin to Hobbes's war of all against all, that in a state of nature, we're killing each other, we're not cooperating, and, you know. But, you know, Kropotkin, like, comes along and he's, like, you know, adamantly insists that mutual aid is a is more of a factor in evolution than competition is. He says that, of course, competition, especially for food, is a defining feature of evolution, but so too is mutual aid. He's like, long ago, the termites and the ants rejected Hobbes's war of all against all and have embraced mutual aid to create a vibrant system. And I think the same could be said for social systems, but the more we cooperate, just as a law of nature, maybe, the more we conserve resources. The more that we conserve resources, the more time we have for ethical and moral development, for like the refinement of our species, right? And that just makes more sense. But the more that we're competing against each other, the more resources we spend defeating each other in war, the weaker our species becomes and the more degraded the environment becomes. So it only makes sense that we're going to maximize cooperation within our species and other species, because that's how we're going to realize the full potential of who we can be, right? As people, as a species, as a much larger ecosystem on this planet.
So along the lines of the mutual aid stuff, another of the things I really liked about the permaculture research I've been doing is like this concept of like cultivating abundance, and like how, you know, from the inside, when people look at like, if people will come to my house and like eat dinner with me, you know, they think, oh, you're a baller, you know, like you're so gourmet or whatever. And it's like, actually, I don't spend shit on food. Like I grow up, like so many of these things that I've built up over time are just, it's this non-taxable wealth that I've built up over time. And but with that, it's like, that's one of the things that like kind of makes me cringe with the permaculture talk, is like, you know, they talk about like social capital, and like in my world, it's like talking about social capital is disgusting, you know, like and so it's like, why, how, like, can you talk about like all the, like, first of all, I just wonder, like, why do they use such capitalistic terms to talk about these things that are much better described with anarchy, with anarchist ideas?
Right. And the answer to that is complex, and I think it's also a part of an ongoing debate within permaculture that's been, you know, raging as far as, like, I've been involved with it. And, well, to first answer your question, like, why does, like, permaculture utilize terms like social capital? It's because within permaculture there's, how do you say this?
Mixed consciousness?
Yeah, mixed consciousness, right. You know, it's not inherently, well, no, it is inherently, in my opinion, like, anti-capitalist. And this is really interesting just about language. Permaculturalists can critique capitalism using ecological or like using like design language. And everyone in a permaculture design course is going to be like, yes, right? And you know, I've been to a permaculture design course where I'm pretty sure there was someone arguing for, or the politics was for the instatement of a theocratic, patriarchal government run by the Mormon Church. Like, I mean, it attracts, you know, people of all different stripes.
Which is awesome.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of strength and a lot of potential there, because you're, you know, potatoes in the ground don't give a shit if you're, you know, Republican, Democrat, anarchist, libertarian, what have you. You know,
I've heard fascism does kill potatoes.
Right. But so, like, going back to this idea of language, so a permaculture can say to a group of varying political ideologies, a system of infinite growth is bad design. If you design a system like that, like, I mean, that doesn't make any sense. But if a permaculturalist teacher or whatever were to say in the same room, capitalism is bad design, you would have a really interesting argument. Right. And you would have a tense political conversation, like, as my experience informed me. And yeah, and there's good and bad to that. But I think we bring to permaculture whatever politics we have. And I'll make the, I'd like to make the assertion that just as the relationship between like anarchism or liberatory politics or ethics made sense in the context of permaculture, I mean, since that was so easy for me, I could see other people like making the same thing. And yeah, and so yeah, it's a really interesting type up, and I think a lot of people within permaculture want to keep it politically ambiguous in that sense,
right?
But there's also a lot of people who want to move away from that. But at its very heart, you find innumerable examples of like a liberatory expressions throughout permaculture. I'm going to butcher this quote. I'll try it anyway, but it's by Robert Hart. He wrote a book called Forest Gardening, and I think that's it. I think that's the title. but he was talking about societies that have been engaged in, you know, forest gardening and, you know, multi-story, like, polycultures for millennia as being incredibly free, you know. And I think the quote is something like, you know, it is surmised that those cultures that cultivated these polycultures enjoyed a freedom incommensurate, completely at odds to those societies that impose monocultures on the land and monocultures with the people, right? That there's a sort of inherent, like, liberatory expression in working with nature and allowing nature to express itself to, you know, the ecosystem benefit and people benefit, than there is of, you know, trying to impose a monoculture on the land, you know. And monoculture is probably the agricultural expression of modern industrialized society, the effects of which we are witnessing everywhere: climate change, mass extinction of species, overloading of the phosphorus and nitrogen cycles, all the global ecological crises together are taken from like a very poor conception of who we are as people and a severe lack of imagination on how to organize society.
Yeah. I mean, shit, I forgot what I was gonna... And that's what it is. So it's like, you know, this idea of, like, nature as, like, nature is this house. Like, nature is everywhere, mm-hmm. You know? Like, everything that is the activity of the human can be called nature. And I think that's one of the things that I actually like about the way that I also respect about the way they talk about, like, capital and abundance, mm-hmm. is that, like, it's like they're... You know, it's like harnessing all the flows of energy. Like, you can't, like money exists in the world.
Right.
And so it's like, okay, if we're going to live in a world that operates on money, then, you know, acknowledging its existence and incorporating that into our anti-capitalism I think it's important. It's like, you know, a wise man once said, capitalism has infiltrated every aspect of our lives, mm-hmm. at this point. Mm-hmm. So we can, what do we do? We kill ourselves? So Facebook can't monetize us anymore?
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's truly inescapable. And one of the resilient features of capitalism, and you have to give it up for capitalism for being so incredibly fucking resilient against almost any threat that it has ever faced, of course. You know, it is the hegemonic system globally. It's also incredibly, I wouldn't say efficient, but successful at mobilizing resources, like, on a global scale. But yeah, I mean, especially in advanced Western, you know, like, countries like the U.S., late capitalism, you could go off into the woods and start a permaculture farm there, but they're still going to cut the forest down. And I'm kind of quoting Bill Mollison here. He's like, you can go off to the scrub or the brush or the, you know, forest and create your own little Eden out there, but they're still going to use the forest for wood. They're still going to you know, see the environment as a resource to be exploited and extracted from, not something to engage with and, you know, like, develop together.
You were talking also about, because one of the things in here is they were like, I was listening to an interview, I think, on Permaculture Voices with Toby Hemingway, and he was talking about how, like, this tactic of going into the poor communities and building herb spirals and, like, looking at, like, you know, the people who need this stuff aren't getting it, but, like, how just, like, going in and, you know, planting a food forest in the hood, it's not going to be the answer. But then you were talking about one of the projects that one of your students did at a trailer park, that kind of flew in the face of that. So I was just wondering, what are your thoughts on?
Yeah, I mean, so much of it is based on context, to, like, use your like first example of Toby Hemingway, let's, you know, go into low-income communities or communities historically marginalized and start building out permaculture and, you know, like, greening the ghetto, as it were. Anyone engaged in that project needs to be incredibly careful, like we were talking about when we, you know, first started the interview, that they don't themselves become the pioneer species, that they don't set forward the processes of gentrification, like, on a particular neighborhood, and talk about the insidious nature of capital and how we can't escape it. Right. People growing gardens in their front yards could actively be participating in their own displacement from their social and ecological place, like their sense of belonging. And so, yeah, again, another critique.
So complex, man.
Right. So I had a group of students work in a mobile home park in Boulder, like one of the only truly affordable housing options for people in Boulder. And they were actually working with another professor in the environmental studies department. She lived in this neighborhood, so she had substantial community ties there, had been involved in a lot of the struggles around, like, issues over water, issues over affordability, issues over voice and impact. Do the residents actually have a voice and impact? And I never would have sent a group of students into a neighborhood that didn't have a translator, that did not already have embedded relationships within that community. And I also make, and I'm very clear with my students that, you know, your decisions could potentially impact this community well beyond the time that you're gone. They will have to live with whatever you do, for better or worse. And so I try to paint a very stark picture of what it means to be engaged in, you know, communities outside the university, particularly low-income communities, that, in the words of permaculture, lack the social, political, cultural capital. Yeah, and again, how permaculture, in a sense, capital is a flow of energy, like you said, right? But perhaps the verbiage should be changed for a more liberatory permaculture. But just back to my you know, original thought, like, it's based on context. I think it's incredibly important that we're aware of how we can use permaculture for good, and to maximize that and to minimize the bad that we're doing.
Any final thoughts about social permaculture and the city and how to make the world safe for humanity?
right. Well, so I'm really interested and excited to be in the position that I'm in, because I come to permaculture without a lot of the ecological knowledge and experience, and it's something that I'm fervently learning right now. But I'm just excited to, you know, start talking about politics more, to talk about like the political implications of our designs, like, especially in an embedded, you know, social, cultural locations as cities that are incredibly complex. I'm definitely looking forward to exploring that more and, like, opening up that more to more and more people, and also engage in just, like, political literacy in general. So,
well, you've helped me a lot, Steve.
And thank you for doing this podcast. And in light of Rhinoceropolis shutting down Seven Circle, I mean, being targeted by right-wing, like, alt-right neo-Nazis, the sort of cultural production that you're involved in is incredibly necessary. So thank you.
Well, thanks, man. And if people want to track you online, you're about to launch a website.
Yeah, I'm about to launch a website And I'm not sure if I know.
It's not your
the
name?
Website. No, it's not.
And if people want to find you on Twitter, you're poke_Steven.
Yeah, at twitter.com. I'm not active on Twitter. But the website is going to be popular-power.com.
Oh, cool.
Permaculture, politics, and place. So nice. I'm going to be talking about the intersections of permaculture, politics, and place.
I smell a book deal, guy.
Yeah, I need to get better by writing crafts. Like, it's something that I need a whole lot of practice on.
Really? You're not good at writing?
No, I mean, I can write. I mean, I can put sentences together, but... yeah, I mean, one of the things that I struggled with my thesis was just, like, long-range planning of, like, how to develop an argument over, you know, numerous pages. And so I think a lot of it, like, again, comes down to design. So I need to, like, become a better designer with writing. So
any book, I always ask everybody, any book recommendations?
Mm-hmm. I mentioned before Robert Hart in his discussion. Or his book on forest gardening was incredibly enlightening to me, not just in terms of strategy, but also philosophy, and his philosophical approach was really inspiring to me. Let me think. As far as like an actual structural how-to manual, like I'm just diving into David Jackie and Eric Tonsmeyer's forest gardening textbook that
you also just read. Yeah. Nice.
And in terms of, you know, like in-depth ecological like strategy, I'm really excited about that one. Bookchin, like I just read an article of his that I really was drawn to, called Liberatory Municipalism. And I mean, I know Bookchin is an incredibly problematic figure, and but I do feel he has a lot of good like ideas out there on how we could organize society from our current position.
A lot of great people are really problematic.
Yeah, right. And yeah, Cindy Milstein. I believe the book is called About Anarchism, or you know, something on anarchism, but it's a primer on anarchism that I found like. Incredibly up to date. I also read a lot of David Graeber, Uri Gordon, and like other anarchist thinkers. But yeah.
You gotta read some Scott Crowe, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Thank you so much, Steven.
You're welcome.
Everywhere, dead bodies on the beach, and y'all don't care. Yeah, all you do is share everything but the burden, it's clear. No snow till June, no hope till doom. Tell Elon Musk he can have Mars or the moon or the world, even if it looks like doom. Ain't life a motherfucker if you stand tall, standing on a pile of other motherfuckers who came before. And trust will inherit the dust on a pan oceanic tour. This goes out to those that disagree with the time. You will see we were right. It's already too late, don't trip. We're going down with the ship tonight. This is Anthropocene Hop with the Microcene Hop. Nobody wanna be the boss no more. To the boss go the flies. Into the world goes the fire. It's terrifying to be alive. Madness reigns these times. So I'm happy to be alive. Right now, I was built for this. Haymarket martyrs were killed for this. Ludlow mothers were blown to bits. While on the Iron Throne, the devil sits. In my skull is dead poets. Hopes and dreams of 4 decades. The conspiracy of gravity and time. And all the disasters that humans have made. I figured I'd be rich by now. Some figured I'd quit by now. All my critics eating shit right now. More freedom than the law allows. Look out, the sky is falling. Whoops, it's on your head. The air is thick with blood. And the blood is thick with lead. I can't sleep since the news. We're soon to be ruled by a giant peach. Motherfucker, I've been woke. So woke, I can barely sleep. To the victor goes the spoils. To the victim goes the tears. And for the rest of us, the next 4 years.